We made this.
Ladies and gentlemen, it was a cold-blooded, premeditated murder.
Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of Read and Buried podcast. I'm Sarah.
I'm Frankie.
And we have the fantastic Chris Hottie with us today.
Welcome, Chris.
Hey, thanks. Great to be here.
Hey, thank you for joining us. Are you America-based, I'm assuming?
I am America-based, American-born, and live in Los Angeles.
So it's early for you, I'm guessing.
Not too bad, 10 a.m. So I've had my swim and my coffee and my newspaper.
Oh, wow.
Just to make sure the world is still with us here on the internet and all is well, yes. So it's cocktail time for you ladies. Right.
That's 10 a.m. for Sarah usually, but yes.
Oh, well, you know, Frankie makes me wait until we finish recording, I'm afraid.
No, podcasting under the influence then. No PUI.
No, I get myself in enough trouble sober. So I can only imagine if I'd
I encourage you to start early. It would be more fun that way.
I am off work this week, so yeah, I've missed an opportunity today.
You don't know what you're inviting, Chris.
We'll do a special episode one day. Just me drunk. Frankie doesn't drink, so.
Pandora's box.
Very much. Well, speaking of where you are, where you're from and all that, I've got a little bio I'm going to read out about you.
Beautiful.
Now. All of these things are taken from the internet, so I hope they're accurate. You can correct me if anything's horribly wrong.
Feel free to embellish, but go ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, to be fair, I don't really need to embellish because it's already very impressive.
Thank you. So
here we go. Chris Hottie is the best-selling author of the Haley Chill thriller series. Born in San Antonio, Texas, but raised in Delaware, he attended Reed College and after graduation moved to New York, where he started writing plays and supported himself working as a graphic artist and a bike messenger. He had several of his plays produced off-Broadway and sold Don Quixote, his first screenplay, to 20th Century Fox, which triggered his move to Hollywood. He would spend more than three decades working as a screenwriter, working in nearly all genres with every major movie studio. In his latest book, The Devil You Know, an associate judge of the Supreme Court is dead, killed by the very police officer assigned to protect him. As shockwaves ripple through the country, Haley Chill's superiors suspect the assassination is only one part of a major conspiracy. When a busload of children is taken hostage in Maui, and a vacationing justice's death is demanded as a ransom, Haley leaps into action. Together with a deputy US Marshal, she embarks on a monumental task of rescuing the children while also protecting the justice. But with danger around every corner and no one to trust, has she finally bitten off more than she can chew? Outside of writing, Chris currently lives in Venice, California, in the company of a classic Triumph motorcycle and a feral cat. As well as being very kind and generous with his time, Chris also makes the most entertaining and unique promotional videos for his books that we've ever seen.
Hey, that sounds pretty good. I got to meet this guy.
He's very impressive.
He's the total package. I like this.
Sounds like it.
I mean, I have to ask about the feral cat because I have one myself. How did you come into possession of him or her?
Well, it was, I think, living under the house. It was a young kitten, which is how I think it was able to be somewhat partially domesticated. So it would never come near me, but then I started putting a bowl of food at the open door, and then I would move the bowl of food closer and closer inside the house. And after about 6 months, the cat was sitting in my lap watching baseball games with me, but never slept inside the house. Unfortunately, there is a sad ending to the feral cat story.
Oh no,
is the cat dead?
I have moved from Venice, California, which is a beach community, to the hills between Pasadena and Glendale, which is pretty radically different from the beach. And I brought the cat with me because there was nowhere else really for the cat to go.
Oh.
And this area I share this area with a lot of wild animals, coyotes, owls. I think there's a bear in the hills above me. So the cat's name was Cat, and the cat lasted about 2 weeks and never came home one night. So,
I'm so sorry to bring up the horror
Frankie, bite. Why would you include the poor cat in the biography?
Because it was such a charming feature.
So, you know, sometimes characters have to get killed off. So.
Okay, I regret asking.
Sorry, I'm going to update that bio. Skull and crossbones on the back of my bio.
Yeah. Or just put like a warning, do not ask about the cat.
That's a good idea. I'll send that out to all my publicists, all my various publicists.
Perfect.
Oh, poor cat.
I'm very sorry for your loss, and I'm sorry that we brought it up and triggered.
That's okay. I appreciate that. And the Triumph motorcycle is up for sale. I'm thinking about getting a little Brit sports car, a little TR6 or something instead.
Nice. Oh, yeah, you need a whole new bio. Frankie can write one for you.
All right. Sure. Hired.
I did so well with this one, so why wouldn't you? Oh, God. Okay, well, off to a great start with the questions on that one. So I'm curious. So we've spoken to other authors who have started as screenwriters as well. Robert Crace, for example, was another one. And I'm really curious to hear about how your process of writing thriller books varies to your script writing background. Is there much difference?
Well, I had been writing screenplays for 3 decades and exclusively screenplays. Before that, I wrote, as you said in your bio, a little theater, and before that, some poetry, and before that, some short stories. But really, for 3 decades, it was only screenplays. And I really didn't know what I was doing when I sat down to start writing one. I took a story that I had considered writing as a screenplay, and the movie business is only getting worse, but 5 years ago was beginning to get quite challenged. So with the encouragement of another screenwriter, I decided to write it as a book. And I didn't really know the rules. Honestly, I didn't have time to read tons of sort of examples of the kind of thriller I might imitate. So I guess that was a good thing, because I really just did it my way. I just winged it. And, the first couple of days I was a little tenuous about it and hesitant. And then the more I did it, by the end of the week, I just felt so much more freedom as a novelist, just in terms of what I could write about, what I could not just write about, but how I could write it, how I could tell my story. So I think I brought a lot of my baggage or skill set or whatever you want to call it from the movie world, just in the sense of certainly my story structure and how I build scenes. I can't shake, you know, all that screenwriting I did, but I think that's good, because I like the kind of books that I do read and have read and enjoyed. I mean, my earliest literary hero was, you know, no big surprise, Ernest Hemingway, when I was a teenager. And, that clean prose and succinct and getting to the point, not a lot of adornment. And that's all kind of dovetails with the way that screenwriting goes down. And I think that's translated to my book writing. So I kind of get things quickly. You know, that's part of the genre too. That's not so special, but also just kind of some of the little stylistic elements that I brought in, like the foretelling of secondary characters. I didn't do a lot of that in the most recent book, but there's some, you know, but it really is essentially just the same. I don't know what Robert Cray said, but, it's sitting down in front of the computer at 9 a.m. and, you know, kind of just, I usually know where I'm going in the day in terms of an outline, and that's it. You know, instead the words go from margin to margin instead of only a halfway there. So I guess it's pretty similar. Telling stories, creating characters.
Yeah.
I think you're absolutely right. The skill set is very beneficial to clearly how you do it, because what the result is a very perfectly paced read that, you know, it's compulsive and keeps moving. And I think that's why it makes for such an engaging book to read, because it's like watching a film, and you write very cinematically in that respect. Mm-hmm. Like you've created a very visual world within your writing. So I'm inclined to, I think you're quite good.
Thank you so much. Well, I appreciate that. I do. You know, I do think, well, a couple of things, but to that original point, you know, I've said this a billion times, but not so often in the UK, so I'll say it again. People in Hollywood, certainly the people who make decisions, whether to buy a screenplay or to make a movie or to act in a movie or whatever, all that stuff, they all hate to read, you know, so they do. I mean, my first job in Hollywood, and the most writers, many of them, their first job in Hollywood is as a script reader, because they don't want, people don't want to read the screenplay. They say it's because they're too busy and far too important, but in reality, they just don't read. Go into their homes, you won't find bookshelves. Consequently, you have to really grab them. You have to not just, you know, we've heard a million times that you have to write the shit out of the first 10 pages and really grab them, but you got to follow through, man, because if it's 10 great pages and then in, like, by page 15, you're not keeping them in your grip, they're going to toss it on the pile because, or off the pile, because there's a stack right next to them of screenplays they need to read. And I really, that's probably the primary impulse that I've brought into writing books is the, you know, having that muscle to writing muscle to really hold on to your reader and not give them too much, not give them too little, and keep things rolling, you know.
Good muscle flex.
Yeah, always flexing. Always be flexing.
That's interesting, though. I suppose that's why crime thriller genre of novels is so hugely popular. It is that genre that grabs you from the outset, isn't it? More so than any other type of novel you might read.
Yeah, and I think, you know, everyone's time is becoming more precious. Everyone's attentions are becoming more divided. You know, it's the era of TikTok and Snapchat and 200 and how many characters are we allowed on Twitter now? But yeah, I mean, it is suited for that, for people to, you know, short chapters. When I first started out with the first book, I wrote longer chapters and, you know, some readers complained about the length of my 20 page chapters. And I see some guys will write like quarter page or half page chapters, which I'm not willing to go there yet. But so, yeah, I think, you know, you read these things and you snatch a read and you read a quick chapter and then proceed with, you know, getting your kid to bed or whatever it might be. And, or if you can, like, you know, if you can get someone's 3 hours of time, you know, write a book that can be consumed in, you know, if not one night and two nights.
Yeah, or a couple of commutes to the office.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. So one of the questions that we ask in every interview is what you enjoy most and least about the writing process. And I know you kind of touched on it slightly already, but what is it around the novel writing process that you like and hate?
These likes and dislikes are shared by both my book writing career and my screenwriting career. I usually build some form of an outline. I'm becoming less dependent on the outline as I, with each book, but I still have a pretty general outline in the sense of one or two pages of just bullet points. But the outlining isn't so bad because you're kind of seeing the thing, you know, completely and sort of having a vision for it. But I really enjoy the first draft. Mm. You know, if I'm really in the zone, so to speak, it really, you know, it's just the best feeling. It really just kind of jumps out. And the best things I've written generally have been, I know I'm writing well when it's just effortless and it's just really kind of pouring out. And I'm learning stuff as it goes down on the page. Because my outlines are so threadbare, it's like, oh, geez, that's really good. Or I, you know, I get excited or I laugh or I cry, not too often, but sometimes. conversely, all subsequent drafts are kind of drudgery because, you know, I don't feel that. I don't feel that. For one thing, it's hard, you know, you're just slapping it down like on that, you know, Jackson Pollock style in that first draft and you're feeling all that excitement and whatnot. And then you have to read it. And it can be quite difficult sometimes to just figure out how to make this I know what I'm trying to say almost always, 99.9%. Sometimes I'm like, what the hell was I trying to do here? But more often than not, it's just trying to make it, you know, make that prose as clear as possible. That's my, one of my pet peeves is if I don't know what the author intends in with their words, I'm just like, well, Jesus, man. I mean, what am I supposed to take away from this? Yeah. So that can just be really laborious. I mean, 90,000 words. And if half of them are clear and well-written, forget about adding story or character or any of that stuff. It's just making the prose read good, you know, That's hard work. So that's my least favorite. But, you know, like the book I'm working on now, I've finished the first draft. The agents have read it. And I'm just setting it aside for a month, and then I'll get back to it and incorporate their notes. And I think that will be better because I've done all that laborious polishing, and now it'll be kind of augmenting the book, making it better, changing characters somewhat to suit, you know, the people smarter than me, what they've decided what it is.
And when you've set it aside, so you've got your month off from it at the moment, do you work on something else or do you stay in the headspace?
I don't work on it. No.
It's a break
it's
for
a break.
You.
My son is graduating from medical school this week. And then the next week, the book comes out. So there's lots of wonderful events and tasks like the one we're engaged in right now. And, you know, it worked out perfectly where I could really, you know, kind of just step away because I think it needs for me to like precisely for that reason to go back, kind of re-energize, more excited. And honestly, I kind of forget stuff, you know, like so I can read it almost fresh as opposed to when I'm polishing the thing, I'll read it to the very end and then I'll just go right back to page one and start again. And that I probably did about four or five of those for the current book. The first book, I didn't do that at all. Deep State, I just I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't really expect people would read it. You know, my hope was that I would be able to get a literary agent with it. And and it just, you know, it was one of those happy, exceeded my expectations type of situations, which don't happen often, but very pleasant when they do that.
A happy little accident.
Yeah.
Have you ever come back to it after one of these breaks and changed something really major, any of your books, not just this one, or are you always pretty set in how it's
I would say that this will be the one where I'm probably making the biggest changes. My, I can't really get into this. The nature of this book, I would say I'm trying to be purposefully vague on orders of all the powers that be. Typically, my editor... I know how I can phrase this. My editor typically, you know, she's Emily Bessler has her own imprint at Atria Books, and she's great, and that is one of the really really happy contrasts with the movie business because the movie business is collaborative, which is a nice word of way of saying they can fuck with anything that you write. That's what they call collaboration, but. You know, Emily really would, she just is very supportive and her changes would be relatively small, nothing like major story elements or character notes or anything, usually just kind of making things clearer and spending a little more time on a particular scene.
Well, it's interesting because we've had quite a lot of authors say to us previously that one of the things that they, I don't think they went as far as hate, but didn't love is when they start getting feedback on their drafts and it can sometimes feel a little bit off. But I'm guessing you've had quite a lot of experience with that with screenwriting.
Oh, yeah.
Was it easier? It's easier to get to that point now.
They're a bunch of babies. They have no idea. I have a rhinoceros skin. They have literally no idea. I don't know why screenwriters, many of the writers in town here who are probably currently marching around the block of Warner Brothers and Sony Studios because we're on strike. I'm still a member of the Writers Guild. I don't know why they don't get into the book game because it's so much better. And so as far as my fellow authors who are complaining about getting feedback on their books,
I think it was more that they just have to keep reading their own books over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a little bit of sensitivity when that one character or an element they think is perfect and they've been told it's not. And yeah. that's like, oh, do you ever get knife that kind of heart. Possessiveness with a character or a detail?
Yeah, I definitely experienced that with this current book, because normally I wouldn't give it to I have a film agent and I have a book agent. My film agent I've been with for probably 32 years or something. My book agent for just a couple. And my book agent, his name is Dan Conaway. And I, you know, he has a lot of experience in the book business. He's been an editor and agent and he's been around a while. And, you know, I trust his judgment about this stuff. He had like four or five fairly, I mean, they weren't substantial notes. But one was like, I think I can say this. It was like he suggested that instead of setting in present day, I set it like 20 or 30 years earlier. And for reasons that one day will become apparent, but I'm not going to tell you now. But
we'll wait.
You know, I consider both of us professionals, and we had a good discussion about it. And I have ultimate say. It's my work of art. And I convinced him, though. I had reasons. It wasn't just because I was being a little pissant artist writer, but because I had a good reason. And this wasn't, you know, this was not an alternate history book. It was something different, or is something different. So, but, you know, he had ideas about one of my main characters. He thought he could be drawn in a substantially different way. And I agree, you know, it's going to be a better book for it. And as long as I've put 8 months of pretty much 6 day a week effort into it, I thought that I should put in the work. So I don't mind that. As long as you, I don't have a wide circle. I mean, I know some authors like have beta readers and writing groups and all that. I don't do that. It's like one or two trusted readers, professionals whose advice I rely on. It's the same way as if they were my doctor or lawyer or whatever. So I don't mind that part.
We have to please have you back when the next book is published so we can get more information about these changes.
Yeah, it's a good one. It's a good one.
Brilliant.
Is it another one in the same series or is it a standalone? Okay. Say no more. I ask no more questions.
I can't say that. It could be one way or the other, but
intriguing.
Here's how you can receive notes that go down easy. And he prefaced his email with his notes by saying seismic potential. So like, you had me at seismic potential huge commercial possibilities. He's like, you can say anything. Go on. Come at me. I don't care. I'll write till the cows come home.
Yeah.
So I'm excited about it. It's going to be a cool book. So I'm very excited.
Sounds exciting. Yeah. And well, let's not get too far ahead. Let's stick with this book for now. Because we're allowed to talk about that.
Yeah.
and your series in general. So this is the fifth in the series, is that correct?
Well, 4.5, because I wrote a novella between...
Yeah, I think that's what I was counting,
Between the second and third book. And there's somewhat... I mean, there's a fair amount of connective tissue between the books. They're somewhat serialized. I would say this fourth book is definitely by far the most standalone, because the first 3.5 books, they had very much an ongoing serialized narrative thread about my protagonist's father and her relationship with the father and the mystery behind his death and who he was. But this fourth book, she's done with that. That's in the past. And she's in a little bit of rough shape from everything she experienced in the third book in Storm Rising. So I love this book. And people, The Devil You Know, people seem to, early reads, there's a real appreciation for it, because it really, I wrote it very much, it's just kind of a straightforward thriller. Storm Rising had, I wrote Storm Rising in 2020, which I know on your side of the Atlantic, things were a little rough. And things were a little rough here.
And we did have that in common, yes.
And so that book I wrote just had to be, you know, had to reflect that. I don't know how the hell you just kind of write your usual, whatever it might be. So it was dark, and it was, you know, the major theme of that book was white supremacy and the U.S. military. And it was exhausting to write. And it was an exhausting year to or year or two to live through. And so after that, coming out of that, I really wanted to write just a straightforward kind of balls out thriller. And I think that's what has happened with The Devil You Know.
Oh, definitely. And I think that's, you've made a really good point. I think you can pick this book up and still enjoy it, appreciate it, get everything you need about the characters without necessarily having read the whole series. Yes. It's still very, very enjoyable and compelling. Yeah. So yeah. That's a great access route for a new reader.
You
as
might
well.
Have some question of like, I mean, her, Haley Chill, her association with, is it, you only read that book, right? You've only read The Devil You Know, you guys? So did you, was it clear enough to you who Haley Chill was and who she worked for?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, good.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, that's what I mean. I think anybody could pick that up and get it pretty quickly and then get into the story. Yeah. So no.
Because the first book and even the second book are all part of the kind of like establishing almost the, like in a way, the origin story of Haley Chill. And I think I can categorically say here on this podcast that the this is not, you know, book four of the Haley Chill series is not the last we'll see of her.
Okay.
Excellent. I'm also now very much looking forward to going back and reading the first three and getting the backstory and the
like a prequel
the story. And
I'm also really curious, when you wrote the first one, Deep State was the first in the series. Mm-hmm. When you started that first book, did you see it as a series or did you see it as a standalone when you had the time of writing?
Well, you know, getting back to what I said before about not knowing what I was doing, I had no idea. So I wrote it as a standalone. Again, this is another happy accident. And my agent sent it to Emily Bessler. Emily was the first submission. And she read half of it and responded to my agent with an email saying, I'd love this. Well, what's his idea for the next one? And I was like, what? I had no idea.
Brilliant.
But, you know, I already come from a world where, you know, Hollywood had already, you know, in the last 10, 15 years had become a world of franchises. So I think it was just kind of built in to me to write a character that was franchisable. I mean, so it was like really easy to come up with an idea for a next one. And I quickly and happily realized, unlike the movie business, Emily wasn't looking for a, you know, 14-page treatment of the next one, but essentially, you know, what I think I said was cyber warfare cripples America or something like that. And, you know, she was like, love it. You know, great. Let's go.
Great.
So, no pressure.
I'm like, well, someone pinch me. Did I die? Is this heaven? This feels like heaven.
I feel like you should be going down to the picket lines and just sort of handing out leaflets about how much better it is to be an author.
Or maybe not. This would be my third strike, when I started in Hollywood in 1987, and a year later we had 4 or 5 month strike, again in 2007, 2008. So it's not fun, and I can't say that I regret my pivot. I made the pivot into full-time book writing. I mean, I had already decided, even before I sold the first book, I was like, I love doing this. I want to keep doing this. So pretty much, you know, pretty much except for the adaptation of my own books, I think I'm ready to hang up my picket sign or leave it to the next gen, you know?
Yeah.
Well, but an adaptation would be fantastic. Yes. So.
Yeah. And we're in discussions that are now on hold until the writer's strike is over.
Yeah.
Makes sense. I mean, obviously we're talking mainly about The Devil You Know, but there's so many rich kind of characters in it. And it also, as I said, mentioned in the little bio bit that I read out, she's not completely alone on this journey. She's got the Deputy U.S. Marshal to kind of bounce off and work with. How do you kind of go about including new kind of building relationships with characters that are so existing, and you've obviously built worlds around Hayley already in her backstory? How do you then go and introduce a new one? Is that a daunting process, or does it feel natural in line with the narrative?
Well, I like it because I know other series, they'll build characters that recur from book to book, and sometimes those characters might take a more prominent role than your franchise character. I guess this is more the Jack Reacher, you know, kind of subgenre of thriller protagonists, in the sense that there's really, except for family members that kind of are mentioned or might make an appearance, there's only one character who recurs from book to book, and that's essentially kind of her handler, and he doesn't have much of a presence. It's just more fun for me. You know, a series is hard enough to make it new, and if you're carrying forward a handful of characters as opposed to just one, I think it risks getting repetitive. So I enjoy, you know, creating in each book, she has sort of a new partner. And in the past, I can't speak to the current book because I don't want to spoil it, but, you know, her partners have a high mortality rate. And so there's no question of bringing them forward. In the first book, I don't think it's a huge spoiler that Hayley has a tendency when she drinks that's displayed in this book, isn't it? I think so, of drinking and then getting a little frisky. So
that was the best of us.
I had in the first book, she makes an unfortunate boyfriend of a Secret Service agent, and I'm getting confused. I'm conflating. I think it's in the second book. She makes a boyfriend of a firefighter, and unlike the boyfriend in the first book, this guy's a really good guy. And and then at some point, either at the end of the second book or beginning of the third, I reveal that guy, they ended up breaking up, and people gave me a really hard time about that. Like, oh, I can't believe
emotional investment.
You know, I can't believe she's, you know, because people really like this dude, this firefighter in DC. And I was like, man, that is not the stuff of drama, you know, like if she's in a stable relationship.
Happily ever after.
maybe on certain cable channels, but not my book. So she's a bit of a lone wolf. She's a samurai warrior. I don't see her kind of always having a team. She's not a team. It's not a Mission Impossible thing. She's alone. I like that.
Yeah.
I like that about her character. She does have her sidekick, you know. Is it a spoiler? Or the April character, you know?
I don't think that's a big spoiler. Yeah, that's okay.
I mean, she was a character. April Wu was a character that is from the first and second book, mainly as a rival in her training. They were the two top candidates, and they had a rivalry that initiated with, I think, Hayley breaking April's finger in a little mix-up in the cafeteria. But anyway, they become quite close. As rivals sometimes do, they became quite close. And then, this is a spoiler. I can't really get into this. Something happens with April, but we don't lose her forever through a little literary device that has been used since Willie Shakespeare's time, so probably
You didn't move her to Pasadena, like your poor cat.
No, yeah, the coyotes didn't get her. No.
Good. Oh, glad to hear that. And speaking of characters and characters from your books, another question we like to ask is, if you had to be a character from one of your books, who would you be and why?
Well, I think the third book, Storm Rising, remember I was talking about her partners who, with the uncertain mortality rate, yes. The Reeves County Deputy Sheriff Jay Gibbs is a... I loved writing that character. He's a deputy sheriff in a kind of very rural part of West Texas, and he's kind of investigating some of the bad things that are happening out in that country. At the same time, Haley shows up, you know, kind of fish out of water from Washington D.C., and so they make a real unlikely pair. And he's just a great character. He lives kind of in his parents' house with the screen door that bangs in the wind and drives a big, you know, sheriff's deputy SUV. And he's a fellow of not too many words, unlike me. And but he does like me. He wants to be a thriller writer. And so he reads a lot of paperback, you know, thriller novels and aspires to being a writer. And he proves to be a real boon to Haley in her quest in that book, Storm Rising. And he has a very heroic and glorious last stand and defense of Haley. So I thought that would be a great character to be, that guy.
I like that. Also, who doesn't want to just read hundreds of thriller books? Life.
Yeah, he's a good guy. He's a good one.
He's not a dreamy firefighter, but I guess he's okay.
he'll do. So are you a fairly prolific reader yourself, or do you try to avoid getting buried in?
You know, I have stacks of books everywhere, either from, you know, my fellow authors or things I buy because I hear about them and I want to get to them. You know, I have a copy of Slow Horses on my bedstand that I've barely cracked. It's a hard thing, you know, because I'm sitting in front of the computer when I'm writing. I'm sitting at a computer reading for hours, you know, especially when I'm rewriting and polishing. The last thing I want to do is read when I get off this computer. And then I read a fair amount of nonfiction for research. So, you know, I hate to say it, I'm not a prolific reader, but I try to. It's like pizza. You want to make it. If you're going to eat pizza, you want to make sure it's really good pizza.
Yep.
So yeah, I mean the last, and it's hard for me to really find a book I love. Like the book that I just absolutely devoured most recently was I'm afraid to say it was a fair amount of time ago. It was probably about a year and a half ago. I read, and I tend to read outside my genre, and this was a more of a literary novel. I read Jonathan Franzen's Crossroads, and that takes place in a, you know, in the 70s, which is when I was a, you know, young teenager in America. And I just love his writing. I mean, his writing just absolutely, you know, I don't feel like I'm reading writing. I'm just really kind of experiencing the world and characters that he creates. Mm. And so I love that book. And I've loved all his books. And so I always look forward to his next book, which are fairly infrequent as it is in the literary fiction world. But in sort of the genre, in my genre, I guess the book I like the most recently, it's something short of love. I would call it a strong like or love-ish, was City on Fire. I like Don Winslow's stuff. So, and I'm anxious to get to the second book in that trilogy.
And I've got to ask as well, because I love a nonfiction book. Are there any nonfiction books you've read recently or not recently that you've really, really enjoyed?
Oh, well, I'm currently kind of dipping into, I was hoping to be able to read more with this break, but it's been busy. But I've been reading a I can't remember the author, but I'm reading a biography of Edgar Allan Poe. Really fascinating.
Oh,
wow.
Oh,
guy.
Fantastic.
Really, yeah. Really weird.
I can imagine.
Real quirky. Yeah.
I love him. He's just amazing. So yeah, I'm reading a Poe biography.
Fascinating. Mm. Well, another question that we ask every author we speak to, which maybe you won't have such a strong opinion on if you don't read a huge amount of crime yourself, but is there a typical sort of crime genre trope that pops up in novels repeatedly that you, I was going to say hate, or that you're sick of?
I think, well, this might be more of a, I don't know if this is a more of a crime TV thing. You can tell me if this happens as much in crime books, but I imagine it does, but it's the barfing rookie detective in the morgue.
Yes. Yes. Or at the crime scene for the first time as well.
Yes.
Yep.
If I write that scene, it's going to be like, he's going to, and I wouldn't do like the forensic guy who's like eating his sub sandwich either, because I've seen that a billion times. So there's got to be some other way to play that scene. And that's what's so great about writing is like, you get to that scene, you need that forensic morgue scene. It's like, so how are we going to do that differently? And so that's the fun of writing. That's that first drafting. It's like morgue scene, you know, like it's the plot points, like some, you know, they pull the you know, moth out of the ear or the nose, wherever, mouth. I can't remember which. In Silence of the Lambs,
right? Yeah.
But how to characterize the people in that scene is, that's what's fun. Mm. If you can come up with new ideas, avoid those tropes.
Mm. Yeah, definitely.
If possible.
Yeah. She's looking at me now because she knows it's time for the question that she likes me to ask it.
Okay.
Because
Frankie does it so well. She's a performer.
Now you're building it off and it's going to be a real anticlimax, but I'll do my best.
No pressure.
So, Chris, yes. I'm afraid I have some terrible news to tell you. You have committed a terrible crime. So terrible and heinous, in fact, that you've been arrested, obviously, and you're getting the death penalty.
Oh my God.
I know. First part of this question is, what did you do, Chris, to warrant this result?
I killed somebody and I can't specify who.
Okay.
Oh, smart. Yeah, don't incriminate
yourself.
But
I definitely killed them.
Yeah. There's no shadow of a doubt there.
And notice I said them too, because I'm clever like that.
You're masking it very well, absolutely.
Yeah.
You're not the first person to confess to murder on this podcast, so don't worry, you're in good company.
Yeah, I imagine that's, you know, it's...
Yes. Comes with the territory.
Yeah, exactly.
Somewhat. Okay, so you've committed murder to an unnamed individual, mm-hmm. or maybe a group, we're not sure.
Definitely individual.
Okay, that's nice. That's good. That's not so bad. But bad enough that you got the death penalty, I'm afraid. But the good news is, it's not all doom and gloom for you, Chris, because we're going to make you the death row meal of your dreams. Hooray!
Okay.
Are you a foodie person?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not like... you know, a certain kind, I like kind of normal food, but prepared really well, like see above comment about pizza. So, yeah.
Okay.
Well, to reassure you, Frankie and I will not actually be cooking it. We will just arrange
unless
for it to
want
be cooked by someone amazing.
Right.
We can, though. I mean, we're not bad.
Okay.
But with that in mind, what would your death row meal be?
Well, given the present company, I would say I'm going to die, right? I'm definitely dying.
Unfortunately,
I want fish and chips wrapped in your favorite tabloid of the day. I don't care how much ink gets on that fish and chips.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah. I don't think I've got a favorite tabloid. I think I hate them all equally, but you know.
I don't know if you know much about the British tabloid press. They're not the best.
No.
Yeah. But great for wrapping greasy food in.
There you go. Well, I think that's the proper commentary.
Okay, good choice. I think we've had fish and chips on the podcast before.
I don't think so, but now I really want fish and chips.
Yes, what's you're the, a pioneer.
That's what you guys are going to have for dinner tonight. What's the most standard response?
I think we've had quite a lot of pastas.
Yeah,
pastas.
We have.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We've had some roasts, some really good roast dinners with everything as well.
Yeah, most of the authors we speak to are British, yeah. So roast
dinners.
You'll
never get
the
roast response from, I really seriously doubt that. No one will say a really good roast.
I was trying to think of other American, of Robert Crace. He chose a massive apple pie so big that he could swim in it and get third degree burns, he said. I think that was pretty much the exact word he used.
That's good. I would put some ice cream on that apple pie, but...
Nice.
Yeah.
To cool the
well, you
cool
can
the
have
burns.
Dessert if you'd like. We can get you apple pie too, or an alternative.
You don't have to have the one that he's been swimming in.
Since flattery, or what is it? The imitation is the something flattery or whatever.
Sincerest form.
So I'm going to steal Robert's idea and just glom it onto mine. So after that,
nice.
That incredibly greasy fish and chips, then I need a proper. Pint with that for sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then wash it, you know, and then keep a little in the glass to wash down that apple pie and ice cream.
Good choice.
Oh, sounds glorious. Mm. Whatever my housemate is making us for dinner tonight is going to be disappointing now. So thank
you. Throw it in the bin.
She'll be thrilled when I tell her what is this shit.
And also, what kind of pints do you like?
I like I'm more of a Pilsner guy than a kind of a dark stout.
Mm-hmm.
But I would probably go, if I was, if I'm being held in a cell in the Tower of London, they're not keeping people in the Tower of London anymore, are they? But anyway, this is all
well,
fictional.
We've been a while, so. But... Yeah.
If I'm in a slammer, and I would get a black and tan, I think, with that.
Nice.
Black and tan. Mm-hmm.
Nice.
Good picks. I like that. So further good news that, well, bad news first, you're now dead.
Yeah, you're dead. Sorry.
Sad. But one final bit of good news in relation to that, we will arrange for you to be buried with any book you please. What book do you want to take with you?
Oh, after I've been executed for killing.
Yeah, the warden is weirdly sentimental about books for some reason. He's going to pop one in.
Magician Among the Spirits by Harry Houdini. Because he's going to help me
Frankie's
communicate.
Face is
I mean,
twitching.
That book will help me communicate from that world
Smart.
To this.
I love it. Frankie hates magicians, but great
now,
pick, I think.
Now, let's...
People hate clowns, no, not magicians, Frankie.
I have
magicians.
My reasons, Chris. But ultimately, though, Harry Houdini, he was all about proving that they were all fakes,
yes,
weren't they?
That's right. But this book was about... I think he did have embrace a certain spiritualism.
Mm.
Yeah, it was... He didn't like the other people who... the shameless charlatans, but he did... believe in the afterlife.
Yeah, that makes sense.
You're going in prepared. I like this.
I like these kinds of answers as well, where people try and hack the system. Fiona Cummins, another author we spoke to, she took a book about how to become a vampire with her. And it's like, that's quite smart. So
I like that.
Comes, yeah.
A woman after my like own that. Heart. And what...
Literally.
I mean, what are some other ideas that people have? Because it was a good question.
Thanks.
We have quite a few people take... favorite books from their childhood. We've had people take really massive books trying to get the most bang for their buck. Did someone say the complete works of Shakespeare? Or
Jack Dewars took Arabian Nights because he thought that could see him down the River Styx.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And
yeah,
all that.
Or you could go Ulysses, because it would take an eternity to get through it.
There you go.
Exactly.
Exactly that.
I just pissed off like a whole subset of your audience, your Joyce fanatics.
I don't know if we attract that kind of highbrow crowd, to be honest with you, Chris.
No, they checked out many episodes ago.
You never know. Here I was talking about Jonathan Franzen, and so.
Well, that's very true.
Judge a book by its cover.
Indeed.
Absolutely.
Great.
Amazing. Chris, thank you so much for speaking with us. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Oh, I had a blast. Thank you, ladies.
And Chris, so when is the pub date for the UK for The Devil You Know?
Oh, I think it's the 25th.
Perfect.
It's a humdinger, folks.
Yeah, we very much recommend it.
Humdinger, indeed.
Chapter 25 wasn't too much for you ladies?
We're of a strong stock in England. You know, you've heard what we've been through the last few years. Nothing shocks us anymore.
Yeah, I was somewhat apprehensive. I mean, I can't say I enjoyed it. I mean, but it was interesting to write that chapter. And I had some reservations about it. So when I submitted the manuscript to Emily, my editor, I was like, I just want to give you fair warning. You're going to know when you get to this certain section that it gets pretty intense. And I can easily, you know, I can take that out and or change it or tone it down or whatever. And so when I got her editorial letter, I like frantically like went through it trying to see like, you know, her notes on chapter 25, not a word about it. And
really?
In fact, there
Brilliant.
Was a note about She's another tough. Potentially graphic graphically violent scene, and she was like, why do we cut away from this scene, why don't we get to see it? I'm like, okay, I guess chapter 25 was okay then.
Is she okay?
My kind of woman. she's had a bad few years
going on. Wow. And I mean, if that's not the ultimate tease to go and buy the book to find out what's happening in chapter 25, people listening, you've got to do it now, surely.
Mm-hmm. And no paging ahead. You got to work your way into that one. No paging ahead.
Very much so.
Don't go to the bookstore and just open the book to chapter 25. No. That would be...
That's cheating. That's we don't do that. That's
cheating, yeah.
Absolutely. And Chris, Definitely. Where can people find you online to follow you? By the way, your promotional book videos, as I mentioned in the bio, are brilliant. You got Freddy Krueger to endorse your book.
I really
That's
did.
Pretty cool.
That was so much fun doing that. That was a blast.
It's great.
I am on Twitter. I am at least as of 10:57 a.m. Monday, May 15th. I think Twitter is still operating. And I'm on the Facebook, and I am on Instagram. And Chris Hotty at, you know, it very easily found. And please do follow and do engage.
Perfect.
I give away lots of stuff on at least Twitter.
Like from your house. Or...
Yeah, I give stuff away on Twitter.
Okay. Excellent. Another great reason to follow Chris on Twitter, not just for the great videos.
That's right.
Get on
Free
there.
Stuff.
Lovely. Well, thanks for listening, everyone. We'll be back very soon with another episode of the Read and Buried podcast. Sarah, where can people find us and how can they email us?
You can find us at Read and Buried podcast on all the social medias or most of the social medias.
That'll do.
And you can email us at redandburiedpodcast@gmail.com.
Perfect. Well, thank you again, Chris. And thanks to everyone for listening. And we'll speak to you all very soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Hey guys, my name is Tony Black, podcaster and author, and I'm here to tell you about Partisan, a podcast about politics and history in film and entertainment. I'll be joined by guests as we discuss films, TV shows, and maybe a little bit more, examining political and historical topics, such as how Elvis intersects with black cultural history.
In Lerman's film, the idea of the black characters are maybe kind of they're used as catalysts to basically move Elvis forward in his career. I think that's how I saw it.
The rise and fall of Richard Nixon.
It seems to be, historians seem to agree with this, is that he was the first president that really capitalized on the evangelical vote and politicized them.
The disturbing class satire in society and much, much more. Partisan is free to download on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your podcast app of choice. And you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Partisan Pod. I hope you'll vote with your feet and join us on the journey.